use as part of the development approval process?
I would have to defer.
Defer to the legal one?
What GRU would have to say, I would have to defer to others on that, but I mean, I definitely think.
Let me turn to Cynthia, who's an expert on education and has seen a lot more than we have around the country and the world in terms of inculcating these goals and principles in the public. Have you seen cases where communities have turned around on this? I know you have. I've read your books.
Yeah,
but
what
did it take?
Well, I disagree with Pierce that the ethic doesn't exist in West Gainesville. I really believe, so I think about this group, this population that I think of as the caring middle. They would care if they knew, and they don't know. They've grown up with green lawns, and they have an ethical and aesthetic idea that a green lawn is good. And most of us in this room look at that emerald green and we feel, like Del said, we see the all it took to make that lawn green and we're turned off by it. But that's, we just have to remember that that's not true for a majority of people. So someone asked the question about the villages, and I think that's a really good place that I could mention. You know, the largest, I think it's the largest retirement community in the world, and I've spent a lot of time there, and it's been really neat to see the ethic changing in the villages. So people are really starting to tear out lawns in the villages. They're starting to live differently. They're starting to replace grass, plant more native. So I do think that this is a matter of changing the cultural ethic. And yes, I've seen this, and San Antonio is maybe the best example of a large community really dominated by that sort of landscaping that really changed. It changed really with the help, mostly, of the water utility, giving incentives to help those changes happen. And I think that too could happen here in Turnberry or the most water-wasting communities that we have. But what we've done so far hasn't been working. And we know social science research shows that it does not work to shame people or, you know, run the water hogs on the front page of the newspaper. That just pisses people off.
But I feel
promises are better than
what works. What works is to help give them incentives to use less. And what I think works best is to help people understand that direct connection between their hoses and the aquifer and the beautiful spring. And that really can happen, and it just hasn't happened here yet.
Yeah, I mean, we have a good program at GRU, which doesn't cover the whole county. We have a fairly aggressive water conservation program in the county run by a very competent person.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a local newspaper that's all over the issue of water and springs.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, do we just need to wait a few more years for that to all kick in? I mean, are there new techniques, strategy, educational methods that you think we should be trying?
I really think with the caring middle that the mega churches are very big, interesting mm-hmm. new way of reaching people, churches in general, synagogues, places of worship. That is more, that's very interesting right now, and that's having an influence in California. I've done a little bit of research about churches in California who were way out there before Governor Brown in terms of helping people use less and helping communities use less. So I think going to the homeowners association and saying, I want to help you do this, doesn't seem to work. That's just not working. That's what's already been tried. Reaching people in their neighborhoods and their places of worship, that seems to work better. And I think that will happen here. But I really, you know, like I said before, we're sort of going in the opposite direction of the trends. And part of it is, you know, irrigation ordinances. Those types of things were important in San Antonio. It was important to say, I mean, they literally made it illegal to wastewater. If you had a broken sprinkler, which we see all the time here, water just shooting down the street, that is against the law. That's just not allowed to happen. So part of the ethic is, you know, helping people live differently with ordinances, with the laws on the
books. California's certainly looking at large fines at this point. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they've implemented any of them.
I want to mention one other thing, and I don't know the answer to this, but I find it odd that we have this fracture between urban use. We talk about urban use and agricultural use, and there's a great fracture between those two communities, and really that too shouldn't be decoupled, because just as one example, landscape material is the number one agricultural crop in Florida, and the consumers buy it, the farmers grow it. It's all a cycle, and it's all it's really bound tightly. And I'm not sure why we look at it as if there's this kind of water use and this kind of water use, and they're completely separate. They're really intricately tied together, and that ethic is also tied together. If you help people understand, the use of sod and all that goes into it, that's going to influence the farmers who grow the sod. So these things really are connected to one another.
Thank you. Just to add to that, with regards to that coupling, we talked about it before, what you eat has a huge, choice in water quantity and quality. So, it's not like you're just making a choice in your front landscape as to whether or not you're consuming water. It's how you live your life, your lifestyle.
Yeah.
I want to throw one out just because we talked only about Alachua County, and we don't live in a vacuum here. We're influenced by events and activities that take place all around the state, the region, certainly all across the Floridan Aquifer, which is a lot bigger than Alachua County. So let me ask an unanswerable question, which is, can the county be doing anything more to deal with impacts that largely originate from outside the county? And I'm thinking, the one we always hear about is the Jacksonville water permit, which is allowed to go up to 150 to 160 million gallons a day. It dwarfs GRU in several ways, one of which is very little of that water makes its way back into the aquifer as opposed to GRU, where most of it does. Most of it goes out to tide. We can't. Maybe we could sue them. I don't know. But there are a lot of things, again, this kind of goes back to future trends. There's a lot of things that affect our situation here that aren't fixable by an ordinance in this county. I mentioned earlier agriculture moving into North Florida increasingly. That's going to draw down more water. Are there any strategies that we should be thinking about as a county to deal with some of these effects that are originating elsewhere? That's a tough question. Maybe it's more of a legal question than anything else, but I just want to point out, we don't live in a vacuum here. We're influenced by other events. Anyone have a thought on that, or you want to just let it lay there?
I would just say that obviously participating in any sort of regional planning and whatnot, but it seems to me your best foot forward is to show by example what you're doing locally. Mm-hmm. Maybe that doesn't shame, but it certainly gives you a better leverage point for other entities that may be not having that same sort of a low consumption standard if we're talking about quantity. And so it seems to me lead by example, and that inherently may put some influence on
it. There was an op-ed recently in the Sun, I think by Dr. Knight, which pointed out sort of the average drawdown in the aquifer by a GRU customer versus a JEA customer, and the difference was a factor of 3 just because of the ability or the inability to recycle water. So that's part of the, I guess, shaming or public education, however you want to phrase it.
Well, at least you're not throwing rocks when you've got a glass house.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Well, I think also having a framework and thinking about 20 years from now, Alachua County, how the neighboring counties will be impacting the functioning of the county and the environmental quality of the county. If, for example, there's an urban front moving north from Orlando approaching Alachua County. Marion County has some of the highest population growth the state's experiencing. And you know, what are those impacts of those people coming in just down there? What are the neighborhood impacts to the development plan, the economic plan, and the environmental plan of this county? Those are difficult questions to ask, and in 20 years from now, people are going to want to know, you know, what we've done now to start thinking about that, because it is going to be a quite a bit different landscape, as we know. We talked about this population growth. That's real population growth happening in these counties, and what is that impact of these adjacent areas going to look like?
Just for an informational aspect, and Rick's on the same committee I am, looking at a North Florida groundwater model that's being developed to try to get to the answer of that, because we really don't know what the extent of some of these impacts are. So we really have to, from a scientific standpoint, analyze it and educate ourselves, really, how extensive are those impacts? How are they going to carry into our county? Or if they're going to, you know, right now the evidence is not real clear that if those impacts in Jacksonville are even reaching us as far as an impact. But this modeling effort is underway, hopefully within, it's a very slow process, but hopefully within the next couple years we're going to have a functional description of our North Florida aquifer to answer those questions.
The county has some money that's been approved by the commission over the years for hiring consultants to, not peer review, but look at these models and how they affect the county, and I personally think that's money well spent. Hopefully that will, from my perspective at least, continue. We've been here a good while. I used to work for a guy who had a saying, which was, the brain cannot absorb what the seat cannot endure. I think we're pretty close to that point. So we're going to give, in a few minutes, each panelist a couple of minutes to give us their take-home message. We didn't spend probably as much time on solutions or what we can do about the problems we should have, but hopefully in the panelists' couple of minutes at the end here, they can focus on that particular part of this discussion rather than where are we and where are we going, what can we do about it. Mary, would you like to wrap up with a few questions from the audience? Then we'll turn to the panelists. And then after that, if there are any publicly elected officials, I guess that's the way you get elected these days, publicly, who would like to make a comment, they're more than welcome to. And then Mary, perhaps you can wrap up with where EPAC is going with all this.
In terms of additional questions, let's see. Dealt with the villages. How effective are the DRI system and processes in addressing water quality and consumption? In terms of water quality, are there technologies that look promising in helping with discharge? Can something like a carbon fee and dividend structure be used to decrease water usage in industry, with dividends also addressing social equity issues? Why not make it transparent? Publish water usage online by area, subdivision, etc.
Yes.
Is it odd that we are on the east side of town and there are very few people of color at this meeting? What exact regulations, policies, etc. can be done through local and state governing bodies now and in 5 years? Also, how big will Florida's population be in 2050, and do we have enough water?
Does
anybody want to
please take some of those on? The audience has been very patient here and hasn't had a chance to ask any, so I'm trying to answer a few of those if you can. Anybody?
I'll say that I like the idea of making it transparent. I think that's a fabulous idea, and I would like to offer a solution that links explicitly to that idea. The city of Claremont requires all new homes to have 2 meters. It's required to have 2 meters for your irrigation system and for your in-house water. You are given a budget for your irrigation, 35 inches a year. The landscapable area is calculated. You get 35 inches on that area. That's the amount you can have over the course of every year. If you exceed that amount, you're fined. The water management district in the consumptive use permit to the city of Claremont included that they continue that program as a condition of their consumptive use permit. So you can indeed implement what they refer to as a running annual water budget for every metered property. It's already in place. It was in place in 2010. So it's transparent because you're going to know when you get the card that you're going to be fined. And by the way, it's a public utility, so it's already transparent.
You do they fine you or just charge you more for the excessive amount?
It's a fine.
It's a fine.
It's a fine.
That's very interesting.
Pierce, can't we now go on the website and find water use by subdivision?
Not by subdivision. You could calculate that. That's what we've been doing, is trying to aggregate by subdivision. Because subdivisions represent the organizing policy of a group of homes.
Yeah, so will there be a way to get that online for the general public? And is that happening?
That there is a way. I could do it tomorrow. GR, you wanted me to do it.
Up to you with Gainesville Green Yard.
That's what I was referring to, right, with Gainesville Green, because I've seen some of that data online, but I don't know how
Gainesville
easy
Green is by individual property, though, not aggregated into subdivisions, so you can do comparisons of neighborhoods, things like that.
Well, you have the ability to package it however you want.
I'd like Marcus Clark to say a word. We haven't gotten to this question, but you have so much experience in South Florida and other areas with sort of paying people for ecological services. And I think the legislature in the water bill that recently died was leaning very heavily to paying people for, you know, presumed ecological services. Could you just relate briefly to the audience your experience with that? It's an ethical question. It's an economic question. And I think it's an important one. That might apply in this county as well.
Sure. So the program started off as something called the Florida Ranchlands Environmental Services Project. And the idea was to compensate landowners, mostly ranches, for initially the retention of phosphorus on their lands, and then ultimately move to the retention of water on their lands. And to a certain extent, that was very compatible with that particular agricultural production system. And the idea was is that coming up with this public-private partnership would be more cost-effective and implementable in the short term to achieve a net goal, which was to reduce volume and phosphorus flowing into Lake Okeechobee, which has a TMDL and needs a load reduction there. That pilot program ran for 5 years. There was a really strong effort to try to quantify the actual services that were being provided. So if there's public dollars exchanged with private hands, what are you buying? Can we verify that? That service has since been picked up by the South Florida Water Management District as a mechanism by which the goals, again, of water retention north of the lake and phosphorus retention are being implemented. I think that there's a slippery slope when we start to put a dollar value on all services, because next thing we have to pay for everything that's already available and providing that free service in the landscape. So I think it's very useful to recognize the value of environmental services, but if we, you know, commoditize, if that's a word, but generate an economic value for all services, we don't have the dollars to do that, to pay for all of those services that are out there. So I think it's an interesting program that looks at quicker and partnerships on private lands, to which most of the landscape is, to achieve goals such as quantity and quality improvement.
Have you thought about whether it could apply in this county?
Well, I think first off it would be, what's your goal? And the other thing is where does the money come from? Who's paying for this service that is providing something? Because presumably the payer should be the one that's creating the impact on that service. So you know, you have to have a source of money to achieve some sort of an environmental services payment program.
Mark and I sat on next to each other in an advisory panel a week or two ago. I probably shouldn't even go into this, but I can't help myself. University of Florida got a grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, federal grant, I think $500,000, something like that. You know?
I don't know the number.
And the concept is they're going to study the notion of charging users of natural resources, essentially kayakers, canoers, cave divers, figure out how to charge them a fee to then transfer that money to farmers to implement best management practices. There were no ethical questions raised about this. I found it quite troubling why users should be paying polluters to pollute a little bit less.
I think it's broader than that. I think it's to try to evaluate the economic value of the springs relative to the economic value, if you will, of the agricultural or the spring shed system. Because the real challenge becomes the idea that to meet the TMDL target, which is 0.35 milligrams per liter nitrate in the spring, there is going to have to be some significant reductions in loads within the watershed. And who is going to pay for those? Because the agricultural production system only is responsible for going so far with implementation of BMPs. Outside of that, if you're doing enhanced BMPs and other practices, there needs to be dollars that come in from outside. And the question becomes, where do those dollars come from? In certain commodities, if it's a rate payer system, you can oftentimes pass those costs down to the rate payer. Most of us aren't willing to pay more for food, and therefore the agricultural system has, they're price takers. They can't just basically raise their price to implement all the practices. So I think it's a broader evaluation of what are the trade-offs between the values of these two systems, and on top of that, laying the idea of, do we have a payment for environmental services program that could be laid in there, and what would the value be? What would the willingness to pay for the presently, other than entrance fee, service of, you know, kayaking?
This would make a great pro-con in the Gainesville Sun Sunday newspaper, because this is really an economic question. It's also an ethical question, sure. I think. But thank you for presenting a slightly different point of view on that. I'm going to ask one last question, kind of a $64,000 question, and then we'll move on to closing statements if we can. And it reads, given the intrinsic value of our water and wetlands, will we ultimately have to limit growth to protect them? Given all the changes that are coming, we talked population, Mark talked about climate change, will it be impossible in the future to achieve sustainable economic growth and environmental protection? Who wants to tell us that the future is rosy? We can do everything.
I will throw out my thought that what you've just articulated is not possible. It wouldn't be possible to limit growth. We can't put up a fence around the county. And I think, moreover, that when we look at our statewide population projections, we should expect much higher growth than we're expecting in Alachua County because of the possibility of extreme storms in South Florida and sea level rise and storm activity in the coastal areas. I think we're really underestimating what's coming our way in both population growth and agricultural operations moving here from the arid Southwest and Texas.
It's already happening.
And it's already happening, and it's to me, it's very unrealistic to say, should we limit growth, because we can't.
So given that we can't, can we protect the environment given what's coming?
Given that we can't, I think the more important question is, what can we do now? How can we be absolutely more progressive now than we have been to get all of this in place before this inevitable growth happens, you know, instead of waiting?
And we'll give everybody a couple minutes to say what putting all this in place means. Thank you, Cynthia. That's great.
I'll just add one quick comment to that. One of the big challenges, and I think the benefit of having these discussions and a framework, is thinking and envisioning what that growth could be like in the county and how it's going to come, much as you've described. And one classic example of that is, what is the existing land use footprint we have in the county, and what will these people coming here with these new activities do? And you know, on a broader note, this issue of reuse of the existing land footprint is happening not only throughout the United States but globally. And how can we best utilize the existing footprint we have for these agricultural activities? What are the repurposing opportunities that would really make those more efficient? that could perhaps accommodate some relocating agricultural activities. And really just thinking about, you know, we've already have an environmental footprint on the land, and what are the opportunities within that footprint to really sort of densify and maximize the capacity of the county to withstand the growth that we're going to probably face.
Why don't we, before we turn to the 2 or 3 minute closing statements from everyone, if...
Can I ask questions regarding that?
Pardon me?
Can I ask a question directly regarding what he just...
No, you can't. Okay. That'd be fair to everyone. Right? I'm going to be mean to her, I'm going to be mean to you. Let's allow any elected official I see, Commissioner Barley, Commissioner Cornell here, there may be others I'm not seeing. Either of you gentlemen would care to offer a comment, this would be a good time to do it. Mr. Barley?
I wasn't going to say a word, but I think I'm going to seize the bully pulpit at the moment to just say just a couple of things very quickly. And some of you think I'd like to say, you all have probably heard the expression that if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. There's a corollary to that, and that's that we are surrounded by nails, and all we have is a screwdriver. And hammers are owned by others. We go around with our screwdrivers and we whack at the nails. We feel like we have to, like we're ethically obligated to, and we should continue to. We can do some things here locally. We're often accused of pushing the legal limits of what local governments can do. We challenge our legal staff constantly. The things that we do are constantly being threatened by lawsuits, and I think that's where we should be. It is pushing the edge. The infamous Oakmont development that Dr. Jones mentioned.
Commissioner Barley.
I always hate following Commissioner Barley. And I will preface that with I got here late, so maybe that's my excuse. For those of you that have seen my very short time on the dais, I guess I am taking the approach of the approach that the people who elected me told me about for a long, extended period of time. And that was, can, when it's raining and the sprinklers are on, it makes me angry. Can, when I live in Hale Plantation and my grass dies and Hale Plantation makes me replace that with St. Augustine, it makes me angry. So I believe Cynthia has it right, that this change that's happening is happening from the ground up, from the people, And so I believe we have political will right now to do some things that perhaps 10 years ago when Oakmont was approved, maybe we didn't have. And so I would say that from this commissioner's perspective to our Environmental Protection Department, that if you have an opportunity in phase two of the 9 phases of Oakmont, or phase two of Arbor Greens, to say back to this commission, we don't have to just say it's connecting to the utility and therefore it's okay. There are other things that we can do. I want to hear that. I would say that flipping this on its head to where it costs a lot of money to put in irrigation in St. Augustine grass in a new home. I mean, it costs a lot of money because the government's charging fees. I want to hear that. I think it's time, and I think the public has said, certainly to me, that it's time that we change the water, that we get ahead of what California is experiencing right now, that growth is coming, but that growth can come in a way to where if we don't use 500 gallons per yard, but instead we use 40 gallons per yard per day, we can absorb that growth, and we can have the kind of growth that we expect. I think that our protection of our natural resources is going to make this area so much more valuable than everywhere else. And so I think we have a duty and an obligation to protect our water, to protect our wetlands, to protect our natural environment that protects us and protects those around us, because I think that's the kind of future that we all are trying to make. So this commissioner is very interested in this conversation. I apologize for being here late, but I'm tuned in to the irrigation thing, and I think, I'll say one other thing. I think that this is a conversation that we have with ag. I think ag is a big part of this solution, and that that we shouldn't have this divide of ag versus urban, that to the contrary. We need to change our behavior so that we have water to put on the ground for our food that we eat here locally. So I think this is a great opportunity, and I know that the city of Gainesville, some of the commissioners on the city of Gainesville, GRU, is interested in this community being a real example for the future of Florida. So that's what I'll say about that.
Thank you. Thank you both. Go in reverse alphabetical order, a couple minutes each, and focus on solutions. And the last name is only as far as K in the alphabet, Dr. Kramer.
All right. Well, we talked about a lot of pretty broad range of topics and about this issue of climate change and uncertainty. And one of the things, I think, just in closing, I'd like to comment about uncertainty is, you know, it's not all a scary thing in the sense that uncertainty means new opportunities, not only with the population growth this county is going to experience, but with the environment. So, you know, we can, if we develop a good strategy to plan for the future and adapt to knowing what the vulnerabilities are for some of this change, you know, the county could be stronger, and as well, it may be poised to take advantage of sort of the new environmental envelope that we're going to be facing. And it is a pretty radical environmental envelope we're talking about over the next 20 to 50 years. And so it's probably appropriate to really get behind this and start developing a framework to address it and think about it. And, you know, as I said, it's not necessarily, you know, we know there are going to be new people coming in here. There's going to be new land use activity. You know, I think there's an upside as well. So we don't need to focus on it as being necessarily a negative future. It's a changing future and a changing world, and we just need to adapt to that as best we can now.
Thank you. Dr. Jones.
So I don't think Oakmont is infamous. I think it's a very typical Florida suburban development, and I understood that it was approved 10 years ago. I didn't know that, and it was resurrected as the economy came back. But there are many, many small Oakmonts in Alachua County and many more to come. That style of development is it's in place. It's happening, and there's a reason why it's happening. I can't explain exactly why, but I would suspect that in the comp plan and other places there are things that could be done to discourage certain of the aspects, the water-consuming aspects of those communities. There are other things that need to be addressed, transportation and so forth, but certainly the water-consuming aspects could be more directly addressed. There are mechanisms. I am also not saying, I really came across badly and I don't even tell. I'm not saying that the caring middle is unethical. And you didn't say that I said that, but you said that they don't have an ethical sense. That's what came across. What I was trying to say is that ICI, the developer at Oakmont, is not in the business of promoting a particular ethical perspective. They're in the business of selling homes. Once they sell them under the mechanism that currently is in place, you have things happen. I'm going to give you an example. Tomorrow, I'm giving a talk in the villages, Wildwood. The title is, Legally Speaking, Florida-Friendly Landscaping and Planned Communities. I'm on a panel following two other speakers, one of whom is an attorney. Here are four of her ongoing cases, one in Hillsborough County at the Sanctuary at Oak Creek. That homeowner in that community that tried to install a Florida-friendly landscape is currently $55,135 into legal fees and 4 years in litigation against the HOA for the privilege of putting in a Florida-friendly landscape. Now, that person is definitely part of the caring middle. I agree. More so than me. In fact, I wouldn't spend that kind of money. But the HOA has the regulatory and legal authority and the HOA fees to fight that lawsuit against that individual. And I've got three others listed here which I won't read. But my point is that once you get that system in place, embedded, it's going to be very difficult to dislodge. And as a result, what is going to happen at phase two for Oakmont? What could be done with phase two is the fluorescent signs are still up at Arbor's Green. I think it's already settled. Wiles Plantation already settled. But my point is that until you engage these communities that are embedding these practices for another 1,000 homes, you're not going to undo or turn around this trend that we're going in the wrong direction on. However you said that. You said it better than me, but however you said it. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Pierce.
Dr. Mark Clark. So I guess I would say one of the biggest things we've gotten towards is the idea of awareness of this whole budget. And I think, you know, it was earlier coming for many. I think many of us, the middle is there now. I think there's still people that are very naive to the issues. But, you know, between certain, you know, state-level regulatory mechanisms that tripwires and identify impairment, but I think fundamentally everybody doesn't need the science to tell them that things are changing bad way, but the awareness is the first step. Trying to find the solutions are going to be the challenges. I think that, you know, we fundamentally have to change our cultural perception and ethic of water. And I think if we can do that, and I think, you know, the question is how to do that. How do you get the public to look at water in a more valuable sense, but just the way they change the need to use it in ways that I would argue seem wasteful and allocate them perhaps to support food production, which seems really important, and perhaps evaluating what kind of food production there is. But I think it's about developing the budgets, the balances, trying to figure out where are we from an evaluation of how many more people can we handle at what level of consumption, and trying to figure out where that balance is. We never addressed really the question about technologies and things that will be helping us achieve those goals. You know, from a quantity standpoint, it seems to me you just use less. That's the ultimate objective. But from a water quality standpoint, it's source management for sure, but all of our systems are inherently leaky. You cannot have, there's no such thing as really a closed loop unless you're putting it in a greenhouse or a box or something like that. And, although that can be done, that's costly and you can't do it at the scale we need to produce. So I think there are some really interesting, innovative technologies that are out there to really address, not only at the BMP scale that the producers can adopt in an economically feasible way, but alternative, more enhanced technologies to deal with more site-specific issues. So we didn't talk about them, but they're there.
Thank you. Dr. Boucher.
Yes, I'd like to just kind of do a couple positive things. An urban example, an agricultural example, where I think our technology. And actually, Mark and I are working together on some technologies. In the urban setting, an example is Oak Tree Landing out in Gilchrist County, borders on Alachua County. And going through the development in the way that they've gone to zero irrigation, reuse, that particular development can meet the TMDL and increase recharge to Jenny Springs. It can be a benefit as far as a resource to that spring by proper design. There's an example on an urban setting that there's positives. In agricultural setting, there are things that can be done. For example, you can go in and have a crop system irrigated, and during the off season, leave that land fallow, and that produces a lot of increased recharge because of the reduced ET. And actually, we can show that, like, you can grow and irrigate a full season of watermelons. If you leave that field fallow for the rest of the year, you'll recharge more water than what you would use to irrigate that crop. So there are techniques that you can use to balance those water issues. And even from a water quality standpoint, the last example, one that Mark and I are working on, that we can actually sort of close the system in that we can capture the contaminated groundwater under a farm, bring it back up, and utilize that water and the nutrients back in the system and recycle them and do some capture. So there are some positive technologies out there that I think moving forward will help us.
Thank you. Last word belongs to Cynthia Barnett.
Well, I guess I would say that Alachua County should make it its goal to lead the state in a water ethic, in the water ethic we've been talking about, to have the lowest per capita water use in the state. There's no reason we shouldn't be there, you know, especially with all the dominance of student apartments and that sort of housing here. I think that it would be good for us if we set upon this goal to really talk about some bold ideas, maybe no potable water for irrigation, fertilizer ordinance. You know, like I mentioned earlier, there are all these really progressive things happening all over the country and here on campus that aren't systematic. So maybe we could be the community that shows how some of these things become systematic. Like Del just mentioned, creating, you know, when you create a new development, making it so that you have to return some of the permitted groundwater before you can take new groundwater. I've toured net zero water buildings in Seattle that actually create more water than they use. You know, the green roof research at UF is just amazing. That could be helping us become more resilient to both climate change and, you know, help us mitigate pollution. So all these great things are going on, like the panelists have said, but they're not systematic, and that is the ball that's being dropped. And I think maybe our goal as a county could be that we, you know, let's be the county that shows how to make some of this systematic.
Thank you. Yeah. Before we turn to EPAC Chairwoman Mary, please give the panelists a round of applause.
Round of applause not only to our fabulous moderator, but also to David Moritz. Please stand, David. He went to all the work to collect these panelists and collect them. And if I can just bear with me for 2 seconds, could I ask a quick question? How many of you would be interested in coming to the next community conversation about natural resources in 4 weeks? Could I get a show of hands? Excellent. Oh, good. I'm trying to decide if we need to change venues and have one that has a microphone. And also, I would like to invite you to go ahead and think about questions that you might have for that forum, and go ahead and email those to gus@alachuacounty.us. .us, okay. So that's also on the piece of paper in the back that had our statement on it, but it's and in the newspaper article and everything else. But we would love to go ahead and start collecting questions, and I know you guys have them. Anyway, thank
you. What's the date of that?
The date is 4 weeks from today. I believe that's the 27th. Is that right? I don't know. 4 weeks from today. So
I'm pretty sure.
Pretty sure it's 27th. Okay. So I look forward to seeing you guys all again, and thank you very much. Oh, and if you have any suggestions for making this better, please let me know. Okay, thank you.
Good meeting, Mark. Good meeting. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I left.